Accession number 30408, Major Bob Godfrey, Reel 4. Now, so what was the training there? What were the lectures like? I mean, you've said there was an overall bias towards the larger formations, but what were, I mean, were they good lecturers?
Well, as I said, for a start, half of it was academic subjects, and half of it was military. To deal with the academic subjects first, French, English, Spanish, history, literature, maths, science, all the normal academic subjects were taught at various levels, and we were graded, we were streamed according to where we fitted into what they were offering. On the military side, and this was run by, these were run by academics, civilians, not army people, that did the academics. They had all of them arrived at Sandhurst in 1947, having been in the army or the navy or the air force, generally the army, and most of them had distinguished military records doing, and they were pre-war Cambridge or Oxford graduates.
So they were civilian, but only just.
They were civilians, yes, but only just, required. They just experienced the war. On the military side, we had a company commander, we had platoon commanders.
Do you remember your company commander? Was he a big figure for you, or the platoon commander?
The platoon commander was the man for us, Charles Barker, Gordon Highlanders, MC, brilliant, very good man, really, really excellent.
The captain?
Captain, yeah.
And what was he an influence on you? I mean, what was he like?
Oh, a huge influence. He was for a start, he had us at one stage or another. He and his wife had us all round for lunch on Sundays, one by one by one by one, so that we were able to polish up on the way the military behaved in a social environment. He watched over us. He was out on parade, watching us at everything we did. He participated in the lecturing of, I mean, there were a whole set of them. You see, there were four companies in each college, so we had 12 companies. And each company comprised three intakes, the senior platoon, the intermediate platoon, and the junior platoon, and every term you moved up one. So the company commanders watched everything that we did. I should add, by the way, that this, I suggested that we only learnt, and it was true, about how to deploy divisions. We were, the process for introducing us to all of these subjects was by way of model displays. Yeah, we had what were called the model room with tiered seating all around it, and a model would be set up to represent the army advancing to contact, or the army withdrawing, or the army in defence. And these were the way. And then we would go back and we would discuss with our platoon commanders various aspects of what we had been taught in the model room. And that was the sort of general procedure. We would then go out and we never actually deployed, but we would go out and we all had issue bicycles in those days. We all cycled up behind the academy onto what was called Barossa ground and deploy imaginary brigades and so on the hillocks around. That was as far as it ever went tactically.
So toots?
Yes, just about. Tactical exercise without troops. Yeah, just about, yes. Yeah. Now, we went to a platoon commander's tactical course at Warminster immediately after Sandhurst,
so
and then a weapons course at Hythe.
Now, tell me about the weekend where you went away. Then, what did you actually do at the weekend tactical course? The weekend when you went.
We lived in bell tents out on some common near Sandhurst. It was run by our platoon commander. And we did the sort of things that I did when I was an army cadet at school. We crawled all over the common trying to steal the other side's lamp. I mean, you wouldn't believe it, really. And the only other thing is, we came back and we lit a great bonfire. We had to cook our own food, and we had to perform something. Either recite a poem, or tell a story, or sing a song.
Now, there is a real absence of second lieutenant material here.
A real absence. Yes, certainly. Yeah, it did change over the years.
Were you taught leadership in the sense of how to lead men? And by men, I mean a platoon, because that's all you're going to lead for the first...
Yes, that's right. Year. I think, yeah, there was, and you're now reminding me, that the book, which was the Bible, was the book published by none other than Montgomery, Morale, Leadership and Discipline. And that was a textbook we all were issued with.
Now, what was it, a good textbook? Morale, Leadership and Discipline? Now, I've not heard of it.
No,
tell me about that one.
The trouble is, it's so long ago, Peter, that I don't honestly remember much about the content. I mean, it was the usual Montgomery stuff, using examples of his own career to demonstrate his points, as far as I recall.
Do you think it got through to you what you needed to know to lead men?
Not really. I mean, I must say, when I left England to go to Malaya, despite 18 months at Sandhurst, and despite a 2 month tactics course in Warminster, which was geared to Northwest Europe, and despite a 2 month weapons course at Hythe, I didn't feel myself particularly prepared to command a platoon. I did learn very quickly, it's true, so maybe I was more prepared than I imagined.
It's a worthwhile point. So, sir, we will return to this point, because I think it's very interesting. Now, were you trained to behave as an officer in the mess, and generally as an officer? You know,
Dinner nights. Every month we had dinner nights.
So what was a dinner night like?
The dinner night was very rigid, and the food was very moderate, because we were still in the throes of rationing post-war. So the food was nothing to write home about. We had very little alcohol, but we did have to have a glass of port in order to toast the king.
Was it actually an officer's mess, or was it?
Well, it was the cadets' mess. I mean, New College. Right? It was a sort of pruned down officers' mess. We had silver on the tables. The tables were lit, and we were waited on by the staff.
So you were getting an idea of what it
would
be
absolutely.
Like.
Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah, absolutely correct. I mean, we weren't being instructed in it. We were being indoctrinated into it.
So you've been trained whilst doing it.
Correct. Yeah.
Rather than, you know.
Yeah.
What about your assessment? Because one of the things is the assessment of officers, you know, whether they're going to be it. Were you aware of being assessed? And if so, who was doing it?
We were aware, because at the end of every half term, we were given grades. The system was that every subject, whether it was military or academic, were graded with a point system from 1 to 9. 9 being the best and 1 being the worst. How they calculate it, I don't know, but we were told our grades. And you knew that if you were getting anything from 4 upwards, you could be pretty certain that you would pass the course. If you were 3 down to 2, too often, you might well either be put back a term, or very rarely asked to leave. I don't actually remember anybody being asked to leave, come to think of it. Once they were at Sandhurst, I think virtually everybody was commissioned.
Did they give you remedial help? You know, if you got a 2 in something, was someone there for you to go to and say, "Oh, I'm doing really badly at this. Can anything be done to improve me?"
Nobody came to me in that, because I don't think, you know, I was a good average chap all the time, and it's not in my memory that I would have needed it. I didn't ever shine hugely. I mean, the only thing I shone at was there were cadet promotions within the system, from lance corporal to sergeant to under officer, junior under officer to senior under officer. And I was made a lance corporal at the end of the first half term and a corporal at the end of the first term. And I stayed a corporal to the very end. And the boys from other, you know, who were more confident than I gained the full promotions. But I got my lance corporal and corporal promotion for worthless reasons, really. I just happened to be very smart and very good at drill and punctilious in turning out. Which is not much good for...
Was there a final examination?
Yes, there was. And it was on that, you know, it was again graded 1 to 9, as far as I recall. And I think I probably got a grade 5. I don't recall now, interestingly enough. I don't remember.
Were they stressful affairs, the final examinations, or did you already know really what was going to happen?
You already knew pretty well, yeah. I mean, it was during the last... There were three lengthy terms, sort of five-month terms in each. And it was in the last term that you were asked to apply for the regiment of your choice.
Now, that's always a difficult thing to do as well, but for some people. Anyway, what sort of informed your choice?
Well, the fact that I was born in Suffolk, my father had been in the Suffolks, and I wanted nothing but the Suffolk Regiment.
Could you do that?
I put down first choice Suffolk, second choice, no, I left them both gaps, third choice, I left them, just put Suffolk first choice.
Were the Suffolks considered a fact? I mean, was there likely to be a lot of competition for the Suffolk Regiment, or was it that you were likely to get it because it wasn't that fashionable?
They had two vacancies a year. So there were two vacancies for intake 3 and intake 4. And two of my, what were to become later, my very great friends, a chap called Greville Charrington and Tony Cobbold, were in intake 3. And were given commissions into the Suffolk Regiment. So the East Anglian Brigade representative was a Major Palmer in the Essex Regiment, collared hold of me and he said, "I see you put Suffolk Regiment and nothing else." He said, I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, that's not very good because they've already had their two vacancies this year. You won't get in. I could promise you a commission in the Bedford and Hertfordshire Regiment." And I said, "No, sir, thank you. I will stick to Suffolk. I would just as soon do any damn thing, but all I want is a commission in the Suffolk Regiment." The net result of that, he was slightly irritated, but he took the point, really. I was then wheeled up in front of the commandant of Old College, who happened to be Lieutenant Colonel Dick Goodwin, who became General Goodwin, military secretary before retiring from the army, and who had commanded the 1st Suffolk on D-Day. And he interviewed me, and he said, "Well, I can understand your feelings. And I've talked to Colonel William Campbell, your father's previous commanding officer in the First War, and I want you to go and see Brigadier Backhouse, the colonel of the regiment." And so I was whisked off to Bury, where I had an interview with Bertie Backhouse. And he didn't say anything, because he never said anything to anybody ever in his life. He was a real gent, Brigadier Bertie Backhouse.
But taciturn.
Taciturn, indeed taciturn. He was, yes. He was a prisoner of war in the First War and the Second War. Otherwise, he would have distinguished himself, I think. He was very good. Back, I went to Sandhurst, continued my training, called up by Major Palmer. "Well, Godfrey, I don't know about this, but they've said they'll take an extra Suffolk, and you've got it." So I said, "That's marvellous." That was the happiest day of my life, probably for a long time.
You never thought of the Cambridgeshires then?
Well, there were no regulars.
No regulars, of course, no,
sorry. Then, indeed, at that stage, they were artillery anyway. They were like
sorry, that's my fault. Yeah.
ACAC, yeah.
So there wasn't a choice. It was Suffolk or
no,
nothing.
No, Suffolk or nothing. Yeah, you're quite right, because I went to school in Cambridge. You know, but I wanted to follow my father in. You know.
So what happens next then? Anything? Was there a big passing out parade?
Huge passing out parade.
Tell me about it.
1,000 officer cadets on the square, and the adjutant on his white charger, or his grey. The parade was taken by General Field Marshal Sir William Slim, Bill Slim, who was CIGS. And
you did a lot of practice for it, I presume.
Oh, huge amount! Yeah, morning after morning after morning.
And your parents went?
My parents came down the day before, stayed in a home at Queen's Hotel, I think it was, in Farnborough, and brought with me my then girlfriend to go to the passing out ball, which was held the evening before the passing out parade. I always thought that was a dangerous thing to have done, but it's what they did.
And what was the passing out ball like?
Oh, that was great. We were all really smart. We were all in dinner jackets or white tie, and thinking we were Lord, you know, Muck, and it was very good.
I presume your father was pretty proud of you.
I think he was pleased, yeah. I mean, he was very pleased because he wanted to stay in the army, and he was very pleased that one of his sons did. I mean, he was even more pleased later when I got my MC and he came to the palace to see me get it awarded by the Queen. So, yeah.
So, and that was the end. Now, when was your passing out? What, that would be
December the 16th, 1949. Couldn't fail to forget it.
That was your passing out.
Passing out parade. Yeah.
And that you were then a commissioned officer in the
in the Suffolk Regiment.
As a second lieutenant, of course.
Second lieutenant in the Suffolk. Yeah.
Now, so
from that very day. Yeah.
So what happens then? You go. Is it the
went home on leave? Long leave. We had a month, I think. And then I attended the small arms school in Hythe, Kent, to do 2 months weapon training under the auspices of the small arms school corps.
Now, tell me about that course. That would be what, January, I presume?
Yeah, it's January to March, I suppose. Yeah, 2 months. Yeah.
January to March, 1950. And yes. Well, that's a long course to be spending on.
Yes. And we went through all the old things, the same thing with all the same weapons, rigorously, taught by, you know, the cream of the army, really, as far as small arms were concerned.
Was there anything new, though?
Don't think so. Nothing new, no.
So, because was it worthwhile, this course, do you think? Or you'd already done it? It seems that tactics...
I think, actually, having said there was nothing new, I think we learnt a lot more about the idea of velocity and trajectory and so on. And, of course, we had the 2-inch mortar, we learnt that. And the EY rifle, which was the No. 4 rifle with a metal cap on the metal sort of cup on the top, which you dropped your 36 grenade.
Let's do that. Is that the Energa or is that a later one?
No, the Energa. Oh, I've forgotten what the Energa was. Oh dear.
I think it's also a form of rifle grenade. Yeah. Tell me about the rifle grenade, anyway, because
what's called the EY rifle, in extra yoke rifle, because the wooden work of the rifle itself was strengthened by extra banding around it.
And how do you use a rifle grenade with one of these
well,
EY rifles?
Well, you could either have 36 grenade or an 80 grenade. 80 grenade was a phosphorus smoke. To use either of them, you had to screw on the bottom a plug, a flat plate which fitted the diameter of the thing. You put it up, you made sure the lever was inside, and you pulled the pin out. And then you used what was called a ballistite cartridge.
Ballistite?
Ballistite, yeah. What that means, I don't know, but others would. And then you rest the butt of the rifle on the ground and you aim it wherever you think it should go. The idea is to get a huge high trajectory and further flight than you could with throwing these things.
And what range do you think you could get with it, roughly?
Oh, I should think you could get up to 60, 70 yards, I suppose, so 50, 60 yards.
About nearly, well...
Two cricket pitches, three, maybe nearly 100 yards, maybe.
So twice what you could, more than twice
what
you could throw.
Oh, certainly, yes.
What about accuracy? Was it just, was there a method of aiming, or was it just intuitive?
Intuitive, yeah. It was, I don't know whether it was used in Western Europe during the war. It was certainly used in the jungle in Burma during the war, and it was, we carried it in Malaya.
Now, what about the two-inch mortar? You didn't do the three-inch mortar?
No, that's so a special.
Tell me about the two-inch mortar. What did you learn about that?
We learnt that there were, I think, were two, only two sorts of, I don't even know what they're called now, they're not rockets.
Shells.
Shells, I suppose, with fins, high explosive or parachute illuminating. The fire
not smoke, then?
Oh, and smoke, yes, thank you very much. My mind is like a sieve. Yes.
No.
I think then there would have been three types.
And we, how did you use the mortar then? I mean,
we fired it on the ranges at Hythe with live ammunition. We saw the effect of smoke, you're quite right, and learnt the idea of deflecting the thing according to the wind direction and so on to achieve. Yep, that's right. Yeah.
You'd fire it to where it would then blow to where you wanted it to be.
To where you wanted it, correct, yes. Yeah.
Was it accurate weapon? Now that you can aim, it's got things to help you aim and judge the distance.
Yes, just only. I can't remember how it was, how the aiming function occurred. I mean, you've got you had a gradation where you range it for distance. And no, I think you virtually pointed at the target. Quite honestly, you directed it on the target, but you could raise or lower the trajectory to.
Did you practice firing it quickly? I mean, you know, at the speed of fire, because one of the things about mortars, you can fire get a lot of shells up at once. Did you practice that?
Well, a two-inch mortar has to have a trigger.
I'm thinking of the three-inch.
Unlike the three-inch.
Right, no, it's, I'm getting that wrong again. I'm sorry about that.
No, there may have been a date when two-inch were the same, but not ours, no.
Was there any other new weapon while you were there? Because the others are all the same, I presume.
Yeah, we didn't. The replacement for the Sten gun wasn't in then. It was still Sten. We might have been introduced to the Tommy gun, because some British regiments had Tommy guns at that stage.
Thompson
submachine gun.
What did you think of that?
Well, very heavy, not to be carried around for great long times, but very powerful. With a heavy shell, I think it was a 4.5, it was really enormous.
Was it better than the Sten?
Well, in the sense of, you raised the point earlier, the velocity was much more powerful. I don't remember the workings of it, but certainly it. And of course you had the drum magazine, which was and it was less erratic, it broke down less. It was a good weapon.
It had a longer range, did it, or not?
Certainly, yes. You could get accuracy up to, I would say up to 50 yards, not much more. I mean, it was very much a sort of weapon you'd fire from the waist, which is to be discouraged at all times if you can get away with it.
Did you do any, at the small arms school, did you practice different types of firing in the sense of, you know, you've got range firing where you're trying to hit a target, a very simple, ordinary target, yes. And then you've got sort of snapshoot firing and things
yes,
like that.
Yes, we did do that, that's quite right, yes, where you advance through a given territory and engage targets when they pop up at unexpected places. I mean, that's also possible to do on a normal standard range by the figure targets being put up in different positions and so on to test your ability to switch your aim. But yes, no, that was done. Field firing, you're quite right.
Now, so you passed out there around about March 50.
Yes.
What next? Is that the
short leave and then straight down to Warminster for the platoon commander's tactical course.
Now, this is the bit that's going to make up for everything else.
It's going to make you as good a subaltern as you could get in the system for joining an infantry battalion in Northwest Europe. It's not going to do you a lot of good if you're going to Malaya.
Now, tell me what they taught you then. How did they start? Because you didn't know a lot when you went there, did you?
Not a huge amount, no. But we had, remember, we had done a little bit of section and platoon work. I've forgotten now where. At 28th Training Battalion, I suppose, was it? Yes,
yeah,
it was.
I think you mentioned
yes,
it. Yeah,
that's right, yeah.
So how did they start you?
They taught us section and platoon tactics.
Any difference from what we've already discussed, you know, the
we were constantly out on the ranges and in the woods and on the Salisbury Plain putting these tactics into effect. It was a very good practical course in that respect. But Salisbury Plain is ideal training ground for Northwest Europe. There are woods and there are hillocks, there are open patches of ground. Nobody gave a thought for those of us that were going, and there were a number, I can't remember how many of my colleagues on that very course were going to Malaya, but it didn't fit anything that I was to find when I arrived in
Malaya. So no jungle training of any form or preparation for jungle training, or the tactics or the situations?
No, none at all.
When you would, with these sort of platoon X, the sort of tactical things you were doing.
I mean, you should remember that 94, 19, we're talking about early 1950.
About April?
The emergency only broke out in 1948, June 48. So, you know, you've got 49, two years since the emergency started, and there was not, there should have been a course designed to prepare subalterns for the emergency, because after all, by 1950-51, you had about 12 battalions, I think, in Malaya. But no, we weren't given anything.
Now, were you given it? Had they formalised the idea of combat assessment, as they called it later on? You know, whereby you took a situation and you almost went through a formal process to produce what you would do with your various bits of your command sections.
Oh yeah, what we call making appreciations of situations.
Combat appreciations or battle, or did you
just call it combat appreciation?
Now, what was a combat? I know I've half explained it there myself, but I want you to explain. What I mean, were you formally taught that
yes,
stage?
We were. Quite right. You're reminding me, and I think I don't think we ever got that at Sandhurst at all.
So what is a combat appreciation?
Well, it is to assess the... to, first of all, put down what your aim is, and then factors affecting the choice of your aim, factors being strength and dispositions of your own troops, what's known about the enemy, and what's known about the ground. And having put all those things down together, i.e. enemy, own troops, who you've got available, enemy you're up against, the ground, you can construct a plan then. I mean, if you're talking about platoon tactics, it's going to be a pretty simple plan. It's going to be a left or right flanking, using support. If there's nothing in the way of support from outside, it'll be an infantry, platoon section supporting and two sections attacking, using smoke or using 2-inch mortars, etc., to support. But the we just used to call it appreciation of the situation, which allowed you to prepare a plan of action, and then you would prepare from that all, you would prepare your orders.
And that's what you'd be doing out on the exercises on Salisbury Plain?
Yeah, correct.
Anything else you did while you were at Warminster? I don't know how long you were there. You seem to have gone about
months.
April to May, June?
April to June, yeah. Yeah, I...